You're listening to CFBU 103.7 FM's program focused on contemporary issues and ideas that are defining St. Catharines and the broader Niagara community. You're listening to Niagara Voices and Views.
Winter is upon us now. I don't think we can really deny that as we could in the last little while leading up to the end of 2015. And as we get the winter weather warnings, as it gets quite cold and people don't want to go outside, or some of us have to go outside, or I perhaps should just quote a sign I saw at a local cafe this morning that said, "Congratulations, you have gotten out of bed." It is that time of year when depression is a factor, and some of you may have followed a bit of the media noise around Blue Monday this week as to whether or not it's true or whether or not it's just a media creation. But this is a time of year when depression is a factor. But I think we also need to consider that there is no specific time of year when we are really depression-free, or when there isn't that possibility of it. And one of the things that has come up as a topic that people wanted us to look at here on Niagara Voices and Views was the idea of how best to combat stress and stress-related issues and stressed situations, especially in terms of university and in terms of some of our listeners who are Brock students, and how to keep that stress from turning into something overwhelming and damaging your mental health. And one of the things that is a really positive idea in response to this is something called the friendship bench. And that is something that you may have seen some posts about online. You may have seen it covered in a few other media sites. And we're talking to one of the main people behind that today on the show. Not just about how best to sort of deal with notions of stress and depression this time of year as well as others, but also some of the ideas around it that infuse the university space, and some of the ideas and the concerns that maybe as university students or as people within that community, you want to be thinking about this time of year. Sam Fiorella, tell us a little bit about what the Friendship Bench is, what the organization does, what its intentions are, and maybe also mentioning as well how individuals can get involved with this really worthy and really important cause.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, first of all, to talk a little bit about our program. The Friendship Bench, or specifically the Lucas Fiorella Friendship Bench, is a mental health awareness program that we have launched in secondary and post-secondary institutions across the country. The goal of the program, in a nutshell, is to decrease the number of suicides and suicide attempts that there are amongst this age group in the country. The program itself started, maybe a better word is, inspired by my son. My son was a 19-year-old university student, was studying robotics in Carleton University, and took his life about a year and a half ago after silently suffering with depression for a number of years. And the shock of that really sort of woke us up into asking more questions. And it was through that investigation that we both learned more about his activities in reaching out to other kids who were suffering in silence. And in fact, he saved a few people from suicide attempts. And it also taught us about the number of students who are suffering in silence for a variety of reasons. And so those two combined inspired us to start this program. And the program, the way that it operates is we install a yellow bench. We call it the Friendship Bench, in honor of Lucas's efforts to reach out to others who were suffering in college campuses, university campuses, and post-secondary schools. The goal of that bench is to be a constant daily visual reminder to students to take a minute out of their day every day and talk about mental health, talk to their friends, check in with each other, and support each other in this process, because we all know that universities are fraught with stress, are fraught with anxiety. Kids going away, living away from home for the first time, pressures of exams, tuition, getting a job, social issues, social pressures. And so I think it's really important for students to start taking a peer-to-peer approach to mental health awareness and, you know, really paying attention to each other and their own mental health. And so the bench is meant to be almost a soft intervention. Each bench has a plaque on it with our URL, yellowisforhello.org. And what that does is provides links to the resources that are available on that campus so that if they do wish to talk to somebody, they can have instant and quick access to them. And so our volunteer organization works with the school, works with the student services and other volunteer groups that are on campus to raise awareness of the fact that mental health is a concern, that it is the second leading cause of death amongst Canadians between the ages of 15 and 25, 26, and that it's okay to feel stressed and to feel anxious. You know, what's not okay is to not talk about it. And so that's, you know, in a nutshell, what our program is intended to do.
Firstly, let me offer my condolences on your loss, and also just to sort of say that I'm impressed, and I think a number of individuals listening will also be impressed with how you turned that into, and maybe in some ways continuing what your son did in terms of reaching out to others. Some of our listeners may sort of think it's interesting that this show will be going out the same week that there was talk about Blue Monday and talk about that being one of the most down or depressed days of the year, and then sort of seeing some of the media narratives saying that, oh, that's not particularly true. And I remember speaking with a friend of mine who was a student and saying that if it feels that way, it is in fact true. And sort of dealing with all of those problems. Because I think there's also this idea as well in our society of being envious of young people at times and thinking that they have their whole life ahead of them and not always understanding that that's also a significant amount of pressure in terms of what you're doing and the expectations that society places upon you. And understanding, too, that there isn't always a space to speak about it. I think of something like Clara Hughes's notion of let's just talk about these things and getting these concerns out in the open, that sometimes it's like pulling something out of the shadows and it's not quite as frightening as you thought it was.
And that's exactly it. I found in the numerous is an understatement, in the thousands of conversations that I've had in the last year and a half with students, not only my son's colleagues and friends, but other students across this country, one of the things that I've really discovered is that there is almost more pressure on kids today than there has ever been. Tuition is higher than it's ever been. The pressure to compete with not only fellow students from Canada, but the foreign students that are coming in. The competition for grades, competition for jobs, and co-op placements is almost unbearable. Kids are going to university a year earlier than they did when I was in high school. You know, we used to have that grade 13 or, you know, what they call the lap year these days. You know, that's gone. So we're putting more and more pressure on kids to do more and more. And we think, oh, they grow up in a technological age, everything is easier for them. But even that is fraught with pressures because social media has added another dimension of peer pressure and bullying and stress and making them feel that they're not good enough because they're seeing the successes of other people posted across Facebook. And, you know, naturally most people post their successes and never post their failures. So, you know, you add all of these things together and there is an incredible amount of stress that kids just don't talk about. And what's worse, in my experience, in what I've learned over the last year, is that they don't talk about it in part because they don't realize that that's not normal. You know, I remember the stories of my son and a few of his friends who said, you know, in hindsight, we should have known. You know, now that we know he was suffering, we go back to some of his actions or things that he said and did, and we should have known, but we didn't because we weren't educated to look for those signs, and we just thought that was normal, moody teenage behavior. And I think this is one of the problems that this lack of conversation and that this stigma around mental health has is that not only are we not talking about it, we're not even aware that it's a problem half the time until, of course, it's too late. And that's part of what the Friendship Bench organization is trying to do through our Yellow is for Hello campaign. Just that simple act of taking a minute out of your day, sitting down, saying hello to somebody that maybe you haven't spoken to in a while. That hello could start a conversation that might save a life.
I very much like when you used the term earlier of how the benches can be soft interventions, and the idea that it is kind of an intervention, but not in that way that is going to make the person you're concerned about, because that is kind of what we're talking about here, to make the person that you're concerned about sort of seize up and go back to that stigma. Because thinking about what you're talking about with the pressure on young people these days, I think back to, of course, university students, but also when I was teaching in a university session, and you're correct, the expectations on them are in some ways so much higher and so much harsher and so much more intense. And even sort of the idea that standing up and saying that you need a break from this situation or you need a break from this kind of high intensity pressure situation can sometimes work against you in so many ways. I know some of the institutions I taught at, the student services in terms of mental health were excellent, and others I know students avoided because they felt it would get them labeled in a very negative way by some instructors.
And those stories are becoming more and more common. I know there was a recent article in the United States that I just read that Ivy League schools were expelling kids that had mental health issues or went for counseling, or they would temporarily suspend them and then make it really difficult for them to come back because they didn't want to increase their numbers of attempted suicides or mental health issues. You know, they're trying to cull their membership at their schools, which is just horrible. And so, of course, kids are going to not talk about it and not stand up and say, I need some help. You know, even helicopter parenting, which is becoming such a buzzword these days, and, you know, there are more educated parents in this country now than ever. They have educated kids. They get really involved in their lives. They try and micromanage everything. And what they don't realize is that what they're doing is making their kids less independent and putting more pressure on their kids when they actually have to go out into the world because they can't meet those expectations and they haven't been given the opportunity to sort of develop those skills necessary to be more self-sufficient. So with the best of intentions, as a society, we're not really doing right by our kids today on so many levels. And I think all of these factors, it's hard to point to just one, but all of these factors combined have really contributed to the escalating number of attempted suicides and mental health concerns that our teenagers are experiencing.
I would even add, when we're talking about helicopter parenting, and maybe this is something that I think with what you're doing with the Friendship Bench, you're doing well. It's kind of turning around how we talk about it. So when people talk about helicopter parents, they'll talk about how, oh, the children can't do things for themselves or this or that, and immediately move into a kind of negative space. When my thought is that, having known some individuals who had helicopter parents, the moment they have something that doesn't go according to plan, where something goes wrong, as of course things will go wrong, that they panic and they freak out and they don't have the coping skills and they don't have a space in which they can actually sort of say, well, I screwed this up or this went wrong. Or sometimes it's not even screwing things up. I mean, when you were talking before about applying to university, and we'll give away our ages here because I also remember the OAC classes, but also the idea that you would apply to a number of different places and maybe you didn't get into the place you wanted and maybe you had to make secondary choices, which we can look back on now and be like, oh, not that big a deal. But when you're really under a lot of pressure to get into the good university, and when you have helicopter parents that are pushing you in some ways and things do not go according to plan, it can be a really horrifying experience and you don't know how to deal with it.
Exactly. And I know, I remember my own experience with my son. From the age of 4, I've been pushing him to be an engineer. He had that expectation early on, and almost every conversation we had about his education and his marks always referenced back to him being an engineer, because he showed early signs of being great at, you know, connecting and building and mathematics. And so I pushed him really hard that way, and I was involved in every aspect of his life. And I don't really want to sort of be critical of parents, because at the same time, we have pressures that we recognize our kids are going to have to face. And so we're trying to do whatever we can to make them succeed. I know many students in the last couple of years who have told me that they did not get into the university of their choice because their 96% average in high school was not enough to get them into the engineering program they wanted. That's insane. You know, how a high 90, you know, or a 90, even an 85, you know, in many cases doesn't get you into the program that you want or the school that you want. And that's just not one or two kids or one or two schools. This is very, very common these days. And so parents are putting that extra pressure because we recognize that every year that passes, it becomes more and more difficult for our kids to get a job. And, you know, as an employer myself, I know that a university degree is almost meaningless. Certainly, it's a minimum requirement today, but now we have people with doctorates and masters and PhDs that are competing for entry-level jobs. And so we have higher expectations of the recruits that we bring in. And so that, again, puts more pressure on the students and then more pressure on parents who are just trying to do right by their kids.
And I think I would even add that, you know, you're talking about that in a space of the hard sciences, speaking from the cultural areas and the cultural industries. It's the exact same thing. You're seeing a much more competitive field. And as you say, having a BFA, having a BA, that's just the starting point. And it is actually something to consider that you're looking at a generation that in some ways may have to do 8 years of schooling, 12 years of schooling, and all of the financial hardship that comes with that before they can sort of try to fulfill some dreams that they have. And that, I hate to say this, but in some ways that sounds a bit like a prison sentence.
You know what? It is. I just had a conversation with a high school principal the last couple of weeks who told me that a lot of parents are taking their kids out of the math class that is available in the high school and sending them to private classes that they're paying upwards of $10,000 because they guarantee their child will get an A. And these are accredited businesses that are, you know, are able to offer that mark that gets tracked for their report cards and, of course, for their university eligibility. That's the pressure that we're putting on our kids at the ages of 16 and 15. It just becomes unbearable. And I don't believe that what we are doing with the Friendship Bench or this conversation or what others are doing will change that. This is progress. This is where our society is going, a byproduct of the success that we're having with the education. What we're trying to change and what I think we need to realize is that we are putting this type of pressure on our kids, and that if we don't at the same time give them the outlets to talk about what they're struggling with and give them the opportunity to have some form of a release or maybe just take the pressure off of them that they have to do it in 3 years or in 4 years, and that taking a year off after high school is not such a bad thing, that it won't be the worst thing for their career. That type of conversation and opening up that type of freedom to talk about it and to make that okay, I think will, at a minimum, relieve a lot of the stress and anxiety that kids are facing. And it's that core stress and anxiety that's leading kids that don't necessarily have clinical depression or severe depression to consider suicide. We're creating an environment where suicide is becoming all too common a consideration and an option, even for those kids that are not clinically depressed or that don't have a recognizable mental illness. That's just wrong. We have to do something to change that.
So if someone is listening to this, if there's a student at Brock who's listening to this, or if there's parents who are listening to this and they're thinking that they see signs of this, or maybe they're thinking they don't see signs of it and they wonder if they're just missing something, what should they be doing? How can the Friendship Bench facilitate this conversation happening? And as I said, if someone is listening to this right now and they're thinking, how can they move forward on this, as you say, with a kind of soft intervention, what can be done? How can the Friendship Bench help with that?
Okay, well, the first thing I want to say is that if there is anybody listening that feels that they can't take it anymore or that they are stressed. The first thing you got to do is if you're in trouble and you need to talk, call 911 right away if you have that urge or you feel that there's an emergency impending. Otherwise, there are a lot of support services that you should be calling. If you go to the friendshipbench.org or yellowisforhello.org, there's a number of resources that you can connect with right now. In terms of long-term and getting the community involved, the Friendship Bench is intended to do one of two things. Number one, be that soft intervention and get kids to connect with the resources that we have on the plaque that is on the bench. But what we're hearing from students is that they don't want to be told about mental health and getting help. They want to be able to talk about it themselves and almost do a crowdsourcing type of initiative. And that's what the Friendship Bench facilitates within the schools where we donate the bench to. They're telling us that they feel it's okay to talk about mental health because it's coming from their peers. The reality is that more and more universities and colleges and even high schools are increasing the amount of support that they give, the number of staff that they have to support students who are suffering with some form of mental health concern, but students are not taking advantage of those, and that's, you know, for a variety of reasons. And so the message coming from other students is becoming more and more important and more effective. And so if anybody is interested in the program, they can visit our website and request a bench for their school. What we do is we work with local groups as well as businesses and other individuals to fundraise to get the funds together to install a Friendship Bench and our 12-month program at that university. So we encourage anybody interested in getting involved to visit the site and to request a bench for their school.
And as you said, all this information is available at your website. You also have a Facebook page, and there's all of this information that you have online to make this happen, and also some other really excellent resources that you have online at your site as well, in terms of if any students are sort of feeling this kind of pressure, or again, as you say, if the people around those students and their sort of support networks are worried about this, that there's so much information there to sort of make that conversation happen. I also, you know, again, when you say that they want to sort of have the conversation themselves, that kind of comes back again to the idea of how that can create a community that maybe is one that is natural and therefore can continuously act as a kind of safety valve as well when these stresses happen.
Exactly. And one of the, I think, there's the success that we've been having with the program so far has been inspiring for us. The schools that have the program, and we've just started putting benches in schools in September and running our programs from September. So this is all very early days for us. But we're getting, on average, reports that 18% increase, or that there's been an 18% increase in the number of kids asking for help in the schools where we have our programs running. And we're just thrilled with that. And again, the motivators for that, we're told through the students that we talk to and through the counselors that we engage with, is that students are speaking to each other about it and that they're encouraging each other to get that help, and they're recognizing it in each other. That makes a big difference. And the other thing that the students are telling us is important is that this is not a one-day fundraiser, that this is not a one-day or a one-week campaign where we talk about it and then forget about it. Because we know that while we can raise awareness on a Mental Health Awareness Day or Suicide Prevention Day, the minute you get back into your exams and your course loads and working, all of that is forgotten. And so because this bench is a permanent fixture, the campaigns run every day, we are putting out resources in our social streams every day for students and educating them and inspiring kids to do it on their own and share that information and run campaigns inside the schools on a daily basis, we're really starting to see a positive impact.
Sam Fiorella, thank you so much for making time to talk about the Friendship Bench. And again, I would sort of encourage any and all of our listeners to reach out and check out your webpage and check out some of the social media sources in terms of the work and the help that you're offering in making this conversation happen and maybe changing the way the conversation happens. So thank you very much for making the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I'm Bart Gazzola, and these are your cultural events for the week of January 21st, 2016, as brought to you by Niagara Voices and Views. Tonight, Wednesday, January 20th at 7 p.m., the Brock University Film Series presents Macbeth at the Landmark Cinemas at 10 Penn Center, 221 Glendale Avenue. This classic Shakespearean tragedy, starring Marion Cotillard and Michael Fassbinder, will screen one night only. Macbeth, the Thane of Glamis, receives a prophecy from a trio of witches that one day he will become King of Scotland. Consumed by ambition and spurred to action by his wife, Macbeth murders his king and takes the throne for himself. Elizabeth Chitty, whose exhibition Confluence Field Trips is currently on display at the Visa Gallery, and Start Me Up Niagara invite everyone to a talking circle at Start Me Up Niagara at 17 Gale Crescent, Thursday, January 21st. The discussion will address these questions. Who has been displaced by downtown revitalization, and what supports are in place? How can we have both downtown revitalization and better social justice? What roles can the arts play? This will take place in a talking circle format, where one person speaks while the others listen respectfully, and speaker order moves around the circle. You don't have to speak if you only want to listen. This will take place from 7 to 9 p.m. at 17 Gale Crescent. Food Not Bombs will be serving snacks and refreshments throughout the evening. Elizabeth Chitty, Confluence Field Trips, is currently on display at the Visa Gallery in the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts at 15 Artist Commons. This installation is part of the Artist Project, which includes a website, walking project, and performance, in which the public was invited to claim space, see and be seen, hear and be heard, through walking in Canal Valley. The confluence of the title is that of Dix Creek and 12 Mile Creek. The project was predicated by the opening of two arts buildings in St. Catharines that overlook Canal Valley, marking a new phase in a site rich with cycles of wilderness, industry, abandonment, and reclamation. Gallery hours are noon to 5 p.m., Tuesday to Saturday. An exhibition that just opened at Rodman Hall Art Center is Visual Appropriations and Rewritings. This is located in the side gallery. Students in the Brock University courses Intermediate Painting and Interpretive and Critical Writing in the Arts reflect creatively on well-known artists' writings and offer a visual and textual panorama of reinterpreted views. The exhibition will then travel to the University of Innsbruck, Austria, in June 2016. The opening reception for this exhibition is Thursday, January 28th at 7 p.m. Gallery hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday to Friday, and noon to 5 p.m. Saturday and Sundays. Rodman Hall is located at 109 St. Paul Crescent, St. Catharines. The Welland Museum is hosting a new exhibit, Arresting Images, Mugshots from the OPP Museum. It's a collection of 100 historic mugshots dating from 1886 to 1908, assembled by the Niagara Falls, Ontario Police, the precursors of today's Ontario Provincial Police. Arresting Images highlights historical themes and social circumstances of the period, addressing the subjects of crime and law enforcement, as well as the emerging use of photographic portraits as a police identification tool. The exhibit started last week and will be featured at the Welland Museum through May 21, 2016. The museum is located at 140 King Street and is open Tuesday to Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information about the exhibit or the museum, visit their website, wellandmuseum.ca. On Friday, January 22nd, Hot Damn, It's a Queer Slam starts at 7:30 p.m. at the Mate Cafe and Lounge at 241 St. Paul Street. Queer Slam returns to St. Catharines after a one-year absence and guarantees to provide an exciting and enjoyable show. Bring your poems, your stories, your open mic talents, and sign up. The slam is two rounds and the usual poetry slam rules apply. Hot Damn, It's a Queer Slam takes place this Friday, January 22nd at 7:30 p.m., and all are welcome. Also on Friday, January 22nd, the Brock University Department of Music presents the latest installment in their Encore Professional Concert Series. This Friday's concert features the Canadian Guitar Quartet in Partridge Hall at the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre. Since their debut in 1999, the Canadian Guitar Quartet has toured extensively, establishing a reputation as one of the finest guitar ensembles in the world. Order tickets from the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre box office at 905-688-0722 or at firstontariopac.ca/online. This Saturday, the 23rd of January, you can see Dana Kaye at the Mate Cafe and Lounge in downtown St. Catharines at 241 St. Paul Street. Since October of 2014, this duo has been performing and producing music in a playful and exciting manner. Every song is infused with a caring and compassion unmatched, and now they are happy to be bringing them to you this Saturday evening in downtown St. Catharines. Their show begins at 8 p.m. On Sunday, January 24th, the Niagara Symphony Orchestra presents Masterworks 3, Life's Promise, at Partridge Hall in the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre. Featuring soprano Erin Wall and Bradley Thatchick as conductor, come and experience the rediscovered treasure of Hans Roth's symphony and the hope inherent in Spring's Promise. You can also bask in the calm acceptance of the four last songs by Richard Strauss. This poignant music explores the joys and complexities of the human journey and celebrates life's promise fulfilled. For more information, or to purchase tickets, visit firstontariopac.ca, call 905-688-0722, and you can always purchase tickets in person at 250 St. Paul Street. You can round out your weekend by showing your support at the Open Arms Syrian Refugee Fundraiser that starts at 7 p.m. at the Mate Cafe and Lounge this Sunday, January 24th. Red Birch and friends invite you to enjoy an evening of great local music and community spirit in support of the resettlement of Niagara's newest Canadians. All donations to the Niagara Folk Arts Centre. $10 admission at the door. All donations appreciated. This takes place at the Mate Cafe, located at 241 St. Paul Street. Looking ahead to the next week, the next RBC Foundation Music at Noon series is a faculty recital featuring Tim White on trumpet and Leslie Kingham on piano. This takes place at noon on Tuesday, January 26th in the Cairns Recital Hall in the First Ontario Performing Arts Centre. The Tuesday Music at Noon series is generously sponsored by the RBC Foundation. This free concert series takes place most Tuesdays at noon throughout the academic year. Held in the acoustically excellent Cairns Recital Hall, First Ontario Performing Arts Centre, the Music at Noon series provides ample opportunity for artists to display their creativity. This is a free community event, and all are invited to attend and enjoy. I'm Bart Gazzola, and these have been your cultural events for the week of January 21st, 2016, as brought to you by Niagara Voices and Views.
You're listening to Niagara Voices and Views, a program focused on contemporary issues and ideas that are defining St. Catharines and the broader Niagara community. We're inviting you not only to listen to Niagara Voices and Views, but also to get involved and help expand and enrich the conversation about issues in this region. We're looking for researchers, writers, reporters, producers, and hosts to work with CFBU in an environment that will provide experiential learning and skills development. CFBU is excited to help you find your voice about the issues that matter to you and your community. We're always looking for input and opinions. Check out Niagara Voices and Views on Facebook or email us at talk@cfbu.ca. We look forward to hearing from you.
Back in 2014, Mike Saunders had a conversation with Professor Linda Rose Krasner, who's a professor at Brock University, whose areas of expertise include research into youth engagement and how that sort of reflects in some ways in terms of youth interaction and shyness and the larger social dynamic. And this is something that we thought would be interesting to present in tandem with the conversation about the Friendship Bench, as in some ways it touches upon many of the same issues and also offers some insight and some ideas into that space.
Last week on the program, we talked with Dr. Linda Rose Krasner, a professor in the Department of Psychology. I asked Dr. Rose Krasner to come back on the program this week to talk about some of her research being done into youth engagement, specifically to understand the development of social competency of children and youth, with a special focus on the roles parents, peers, and activity involvement all play into the scenario. Here's Dr. Linda Rose Krasner.
Well, currently, the research I'm doing is focusing on young people's involvement in activities such as sports, civic engagement, boys and girls clubs, all the whole range of activities, and the young people's experience in those activities and how it contributes to their development, with a special interest in children who are shy, withdrawn, or what we call socially disinterested.
Socially disinterested?
Yes. So there's a whole group of kids who are... Socially withdrawn is the term, and it involves children who are shy or socially anxious. It involves children who don't play or spend a lot of time with others because they're rejected, but also a group of children who seem to be just not very interested in spending time with other kids, who have a high preference for solitude, who seem to be able to get along with other kids when they want to, but choose to spend a lot of time alone.
Is that part of their upbringing, what they are accustomed to in their upbringing? In other words, are there outside factors that are influencing that, or it's just their natural way of being?
That's one of the things that we are interested in looking at. We suspect that it's a temperament preference, But certainly parenting factors, peer factors, and environmental factors can either enhance or decrease an initial temperamental preference.
This may be me asking an obvious question, but can shyness be overcome, not so much cured, but overcome, or is that just something that some people simply have to live with?
Yes. The answer is yes. Shy behavior, anyway, can be overcome to the extent that people can learn strategies for dealing with anxiety that they may feel in social situations that reduce that anxiety and allow them to interact, that other people would find it hard to believe that they were feeling shy. Whether the physiology that underlies that shyness changes is an open question. Probably extremely shy children will always feel some physiological reaction to social situations. Children who are less extremely shy may lose that physiological reactivity. There have been some, but not a lot, of longitudinal studies that have looked at development over many years. But generally, the answer is yes.
Do we know what is causing shyness overall?
Not really. There's been some work that at least extremely inhibited kids have lowered limbic thresholds right from infancy, where they react strongly to new things, which suggests that there may be some either genetic component or environmental prenatal component or combination of the two, which may predispose them to that. On the other hand, shyness is part of, I think, a normal distribution of sociability and social-like behaviors. So like many other traits, it's the degree to which people feel shy is distributed across the normal population. And many people who would call themselves shy are not negatively affected by being shy. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just sometimes people are more or less shy, and then they can still function relatively well.
I would think there would be sort of degrees of shyness.
Sure.
You know, some people are shy in some situations and not in others. And with other people, it could be the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, not everyone is an extrovert, for which I think we can all be thankful that not everyone is an extrovert, or else probably we'd never get a word in edgewise. But is that social awkwardness in social situations something that can be treated then?
First, yes, it's true that in a class, if I say, you know, how many of you are shy, practically everyone raised their hands, probably like 80%. And I think they reflect what you said. There are some situations that make everyone feel shy. And that's perfectly normal and fine and not necessarily treatable unless it starts to interfere with someone's life. In which case, yes, there are a number of behavioral and cognitive and sometimes even medical ways of dealing with that kind of social anxiety. I think there's an extreme group of people who tend to be socially shy in many situations, and those lives are often negatively affected by these things, and therefore they should be assessed and helped.
Does the friend factor come into play here at all, the number of friends? Because I would think that if you're shy, I think the natural inclination may be, if you're shy, you don't have a lot of friends. That's not necessarily the case. So does the number of friends influence your social awkwardness or lack thereof?
Right. That's a really good question. In our data, as it turns out, the number of friends you have over and above a couple doesn't really make a lot of difference in terms of social competence or social adjustment. But it's important that people have one or two good friends. On the whole, shy kids tend to have fewer friends than non-shy people, but they often have one or two good friends. The issue is the quality of that friendship. And our data show that, on average, the friendships of shy kids tend to be a little less good, a little lower quality than the friendships of non-shy kids. And that's particularly in the areas of, I think, sort of sharing intimacies and maybe even fun than the friendships of not shy kids.
This may be naive of me to ask since I'm not a parent, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is it possible or even wise for a parent to be a friend to their child?
The parent role and the friend role are quite different.
Yeah.
So it's not likely that parent as friend is going to fulfill the same functions as peer as friend. Some of the characteristics of friendship are an equality of voluntary nature of the friendship, the ability to try out things and get honest feedback about peer relationships, about some of the things that parents aren't necessarily in a good position to do, things about what's normative in terms of dress and language, about aggression, about sexual matters, about school stuff. So parents can't really interact with their children on those topics in the same way that peers can.
But they can offer direction.
Yes, in a different way.
with the child's friends. In other words, well, maybe not so much direction, but offer some guidance, perhaps?
In terms of the selection of friends? Because that's one of the areas that parents do have some influence on, especially in younger children, is shaping with whom the child interacts and therefore with whom the child becomes a friend.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was getting at. Because, in other words, what's the parent's role in all of this?
I think parents help someone termed stage manage their children's friendship development in the early years. I think parents can talk with their children about experiences with their friends, provide some coaching, being a consultant, some advice around friendship, and can facilitate children's experiences with and engagement with friends.
On a school level, I think we've all experienced kids who are more popular in school because they're athletic. Does that come into play at all in the work that you're doing? Because, as I say, if you're an all-round great athlete, you're perceived to have a lot of friends. But that's not necessarily always the case. And it's not always the case that it works the other way. You're a lousy athlete, but you could have a lot of friends.
Right. I think it's important to draw a distinction between friendship and popularity.
Mm-hmm.
Popularity is like, who do you like? Who do you see as other people liking? And that's quite different than friendship, which is a one-to-one, more intimate, closer relationship. So someone can be popular in that everyone sees them as likable, but not actually have close friends. So it can be an important difference. What I've been looking at with some colleagues is the experiences of shy, withdrawn children in athletics. And one of the things that we found is, although shy girls don't have a different experience in sports as non-shy girls do, shy boys do report that they think it's less fun, they don't think they're as good at it, and they think they're less competent in it on average, suggesting that shy boys in athletics may not be having as good an experience as others. And so that might be something that coaches and parents want to watch.
Yeah, if I look back on my, especially high school years, although I wasn't considered shy, I was not particularly good at athletics, and I would withdraw more when I was engaging in those activities than when I was, for example, in a more academic setting where I felt more comfortable. So the comfort level has to be there for the kids.
Yes, and because sports plays an important role in youth development, particularly for boys, it is important to look at people's experiences within those sport activities. Maybe there might be sport activities that are more compatible with a shy temperament, perhaps less team or individual sports, perhaps smaller teams as opposed to larger teams, perhaps less competitive compared to more competitive. We don't know the answers to that, but we suggest that this is an important question to look at.
Sometimes in the news you hear about kids who are growing up in a community where there are not a lot of services or community activities available to them to keep them active, and I'm trying to avoid using the word occupied, but I can't think of another word to use. And in an area where there are a lot of community involvement programs, there might be this perception that they don't necessarily have the opportunities so much to get into trouble. They gravitate to some kind of trouble because that's the easiest way.
Yes, that is definitely a theory in the literature that a lot of unstructured time leads to some problems in youth development. And there is some evidence from Europe that young people who even tend to go to activities that are unstructured, so kind of unstructured youth drop-in centers where there's very little adult supervision, if they are associating there with peers who tend to have more problematic behaviors, that leads to an increase amongst all the kids who were there engaging in those problematic behaviors. And that's in comparison and in contrast to more structured activities where there's an adult's regular meetings, there's goals like sports or other activities in the community. And then the theory that one of the reasons that children who are highly engaged in activities show less risk behaviors and greater achievement is because they have less time to get into the risk behaviors. So yes, that's probably part of it.
Would the fact that the community that they grow up in does not have those drop-in centers and support services available to them reflect their social awkwardness in any way or shape or form? In other words, maybe more shy because there's just not as much opportunity for them to get out and socialize.
I'm not sure I can make that connection. I think the areas that have poor services, poor opportunities for young people to get involved, tend to be either rural areas, right, where the population density is low, or poor areas, which already have high risk factors. So it's hard to know which comes first. I mean, there aren't a lot of engagement opportunities in these poor areas, and therefore the young people don't have a lot of constructive things to do, good role models and that kind of stuff. But also, there's a lot of other things going on in those areas that may produce problem behaviors as well. So it's hard to separate out what's causing what.
But if there are more activities available to them, it's certainly not going to hurt.
No, we would expect that it would help.
Yeah. Dr. Dr. Rose Krasner, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk.
That was a professor in the Department of Psychology, Linda Rose Krasner, talking about her research into youth engagement.
You've been listening to Niagara Voices and Views on CFBU 103.7 FM, truly diverse radio broadcasting from Brock University. We hope you've enjoyed this week's show. Niagara Voices and Views is your show that talks to diverse groups and individuals within the Niagara region. We talk about the ideas and issues that help define Niagara. Past episodes of Niagara Voices and Views can be heard online at cfbu.ca, or you can find them at our Facebook page. We're pleased you chose to join us for this week's episode, and hope you'll be with us again next week on CFBU 103.7 FM, Brock Radio.